I'm hoping you got everything last week. Because now we're coming into a completely different understanding. Or not last week, but last month. We're coming into a new and different understanding. We've passed some mark here, and I think I want to share tonight with some general reflections on what I think about craving or clinging, not craving so much. I want to talk a little bit about the way I've seen it, and I think for those of you that are long-term practitioners, I'm probably going to talk about it a little different than you're used to. But I think if you bear with me, you'll begin to understand what it is I'm pointing to and why I think the Buddhist practice is the way it is. So just to put some context around where we're at here. Clinging, what we call clinging, where we're at in this link, is what I would consider the creation of self. And up until this point, we've kind of piddled around the edges of it. But really, this month, we are full on into the creation of a self. It is this creation of self that is going to lead us into suffering. So once clinging happens, we are inevitably going towards suffering. And I don't know this to be true, but I don't personally think you can get outside of clinging. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So I think there are four places on this dependent origination that we can sort of free ourselves or unhook ourselves. The first place is at the end when it's all over and you're suffering and you're like irritated. Then you got some capacity to say, oh, I'm not going to do that again. So we've got some capacity because we can feel something at the end, this pain that comes upon us. Another place, the other two places or the other place has to do with this three grouping here of sense doors, feeling tones, and cravings. Because within the sense doors, the glue of the feeling tones and craving, again, we feel the pain of much of what we have been doing up to that point. As a habit energy, we begin to feel the pain of it and we can get out of it. If we don't get out of the, if we don't wake up, when I say get out, I mean wake up, come to some understanding, pay attention to what's happening. Re-look at what's going on, we will create a self into clinging and it's off to the races. And I think we're stuck with it until we get again to suffering at the end. This is what I think this happens to us all the time. And I want to see if I can talk about a little bit about how this kind of shows up. What happens to us and what to do about it, how to deal with it. So a way that I saw, I tried this on Sunday. I think this works. A way to kind of begin to understand what we're talking about with clinging so that we can put it in a perspective is to begin to see how natural clinging is. How very much a part of the natural mind, this normal way in which the mind relates to things is the same thing with clinging. So our minds has a way of being absorbed into various things. So all the years that I would do these long retreats or go and practice, I practiced the concentration, deep absorption concentration for a long time. And the mind can get very much absorbed, so absorbed that you don't pay attention to anything else. You don't, you're just, you know, in the absorption of whatever's going on. It's like you lose yourself. And for those of you that know about the single pointed concentration, you can begin to see that you get so intimate with an object that you and that object become one. And that's the best way that people explain it. But the felt sense of it is nothing else seems to matter, I guess is the best way to say it. Nothing else matters. Nothing else is, you're not caught and lost in other things. You become obsessed and completely consumed by that object. So if it's the breath, you're obsessed and consumed with the object. And when you go into your teacher interview, you're talking about the breath like you're having a love affair. You're like, oh my God, it was the breath and it was just so beautiful and it was so soft and gentle. It's like there's nothing else for you to deal with. And things like the hindrances have been abandoned. These hindrances are not in your way anymore. So you're not caught up in aversion or desire or anything else. It's just you and that object in that moment. And you become one. It's so beautiful. It's so natural. For years, I thought it was me doing that. And it's so wrong to think that. The mind naturally unifies around an object that we pay attention to and keep aiming and sustaining our attention on it. So we use our mindfulness to pay attention to an object. We aim and sustain our attention. We keep it right there. And over and over and over, the mind will gather and get unified around that object. Very much a normal, natural part of mind. So when you unify the mind around this neutral object, you can come into these deep places of stillness and the pity, the joy, the rapture, all of the seven factors of awakening, of equanimity begins to show up because the mind is content where it's at and it does not falter. But the mind does the exact same thing around clinging. And this is where things get a little sticky. Why we get so stuck in suffering around clinging. So in clinging, there's a craving, right? It comes before. We have some kind of feeling tone. We want something. And that wanting is the place where we don't quite have it, the don't wanting it. We have something we don't want. So the mind begins to obsess over this wanting, not wanting, wanting, not wanting. And you can feel it. You keep coming back to it over and over and over. It's like the mind sustains its attention on this thing that I am craving. And if we're not mindful about what the mind is doing, we get absorbed into that wanting or not wanting. And that same absorption happens in clinging, except the absorption that we get caught in is the self. We get caught up in it and we can no longer see it. I do not believe, at least I have not had this kind of experience of feeling or knowing in the clinging. I can experience this kind of feeling or clinging in the wanting. But when this moves out of wanting, the craving, into clinging, I am no longer, there is nothing else outside of me getting what I want. There's nothing else. And the suffering comes because our clinging is connected to wanting something that we is technically out of our control, right? So there's something we want we don't have, or there's something we don't want we do have. And that absorption into this push-pull activity creates a mess that we can't see. And it's why this whole process becomes so obscured. I did some looking up, and there's four kind of ways that they talk about, some of the commentaries talk about grasping and this clinging, and four different types. And we're going to talk about those in the next talk in a couple of weeks. But for this talk, I want to talk about the reason why we can't see, we can't know that we are absorbed in the thing. And I think that has to do with these four distortions of mind that the mind actually gets absorbed in. So we take a step back here. This clinging, this absorption, is something that we don't do. It's what the mind does. What we do, I guess you could say we do it in mindfulness, we do it on a neutral object of saying, vitaka vichara. We aim and sustain our attention on the object intentionally over and over and over. But in the dependent origination, the mind becomes obsessed and it begins to aim and sustain its attention on this thing that we want until it has this kind of convincing aura to it that this thing that it wants or doesn't want is the key to our liberation. It becomes the key to our liberation, and it's the kind of the root then of how we get stuck in it. And these four distortions that we're going to talk about here in a second is this idea that things are permanent. It gets caught in this idea that something's permanent. We don't even notice that things are not permanent because we're in this distortion that things are permanent. The only time we ever really get that it's not permanent is when something goes askew. Otherwise, everything that happens to us, we think it's permanent. If you have a mind like mine, if I do something twice, that's it. The mind expects me to do it from now on. So I take this long walk around this loop I've created. in my neighborhood. And one day I needed to go to the restroom, but you know, you can't just go in and use the restroom anymore. You have to buy something. So I said, okay, I'm going to buy a salad. Bought the salad and I'm on my walk. I can eat a little salad while I'm walking. That salad was so good. It was so good. It was just a Caesar, but the way they made that dressing, it was so good. So I am walking the next day. And what do you think happened when I got to that place? I started thinking about that Caesar salad. Now, I know clinging. So I am not having that Caesar salad. But I told my friend, I was talking to my friend during the walk, and I must have told her, she said like 9 times about that Caesar salad. She's like, Tori, I got it. It's a good salad. Okay, but it is lettuce, right? So can we just put it in perspective? But my point that I'm saying is, once the mind attaches to something, the wanting is automatic. The wanting is automatic. Our liberation is in that wanting. As painful and as discomforting as it is, the wanting is where our liberation lies. If I had bought that salad a second time, then my mind would be convinced that I have to have that salad every time I walk past that place. And it will dwell on it, dwell on it, dwell on it. Aiming and sustaining, aiming and sustaining, aiming and sustaining. Every time I give into it, I'm pretty much creating the need for me to have it. And then we get stuck in these distortions. The mind now thinks that that salad is what's going to satisfy me. Because when I ate that salad, another thing happened. It gave me this boost of energy because I do a long, long walk. And it's, you know, I live on Capitol Hill, so it's all hill. So I got to go up these hills and down these hills. And that salad just seemed to give me this boost to do these hills. So what do you think? All of a sudden, I'm dragging. I'm telling my friend, I probably should have got that salad because it would have helped me. She's like, don't do it. Don't do it. It's true. This is what we do. Something happens. You get something and you think it's going to last. It's going to be permanent. This is it. It's the permanency. It's the thinking things are going to satisfy us and make things right. It's this needing things to be beautiful and pleasing and pleasurable. And this sense of a personal identification, like it's all about me. Everything is about me, 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 me. All of this is what the mind creates in a narrative that we get absorbed in. Instead of us being absorbed in the present moment, we're absorbed in the story, the narrative, the mind's interpretation of this moment. And when we get absorbed in that moment, we are locked into it. I think there's a reason why we get absorbed in this. And I think it's because of our basic dislike towards impermanence. We just need things to be stable. I like the way Pema Chodron says, I can't remember her quote. I tried to find it. I couldn't find it. But she's like talking about the ego mind. And she goes, I just want a little peace. Can you just leave me alone and give me a little peace? And, you know, she is the queen of suffering. And so it's like this idea, I can see myself saying, oh, okay, I've done all these things. I just want a little peace. I just want something to be steady, stable. This is it right here. That's the way we go into our lives. every moment we wake up. We want it steady, stable, still. We want it to be right, pleasing. Okay, I've had enough with all the disruption already. Let's have some steadiness. And that desire to have that steadiness is rooted in habit. Because the ego mind has no steadiness. It has no stability. It is as temporal as everything else is. It comes and goes. Thoughts come and go. There is no steadiness. Where steadiness comes, where permanency comes, is in habit. And we begin to follow these habits because the habits bring stability into our life. And that stability is what we are really, really looking for. I don't know if I told you guys this, but I saw this video of the world pointed at the, somebody took a camera and pointed it at the Milky Way. And the object of stability was the Milky Way. And then shot footage for about 12 hours, I think it was. And it is the weirdest thing. You can just go on YouTube and kind of look. This earth spinning. You watch the earth moving in a way that we normally never see it, because the stationary object is the Milky Way and not the earth. Usually it's the sky that's moving and the earth is stationary. But when you put this camera on the Milky Way, all of a sudden the earth is moving. And you can see it. It feels like we're about to tip over. How do we stay on the ground? Because we're tipping over. Anyway, this kind of video helps us see a distortion that we don't realize we have. We don't realize when we're in these distortions that these distortions exist. And so what we're trying to do in the Dhamma is to see it. And one of the best ways to see it is not giving in to our habits, because our habits create stability, imaginary stability. Because in the real world, this is where the selfing and the clinging happens. The habit comes up through craving. I want that. We give into it. Because it is stable. It's where the stability of our life comes. But the problem with habits is the only way they work is if they work the same way every time. So our habit now has to be exactly the same. Everything has to line up. All the conditions have to come into place. And then we get what we want. That's good. Sometimes that happens. Most times it doesn't. And when it doesn't, we suffer. But we always suffer unexpectedly, like we didn't know this was going to happen, because we expect the habit to be permanent. And we do it over and over and over and over and over all day, every day, our entire lives. This is what we're like working with here. So the Dhamma doesn't point to the stability of the habit. It points to the stability of impermanence. It points to the stability, the reliability that nothing is going to remain the same. That change is inevitable, and that we're constantly moving and shaving and checking, and things go differently. And maybe my knee doesn't hurt on the walk this day, but that doesn't mean my knee is fixed. It's not going to hurt the next day. It just means it didn't hurt today. That's all it means. This constant leaning into impermanence, we can only do at that craving spot, when we want something to satisfy a discomfort and we don't give in to it. That not giving in to discomfort is what pretty much opens the door for our liberation. Mostly we give in to it. It's it's counter to reality, because reality is never the same. It's more like a river. You never step in the same river twice. And yet we think we're stepping in the same river because we think it's permanent. So the longer I practice, the more blown away I get at what the Buddha saw. You know, I got teachers, Rodney and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon and Philip. I got all these teachers that says, oh yes, aim and sustain. You know, Guy Armstrong's really good. Aim and sustain. Vitaka Vichara. This is how you practice and get deep meditation. I've been trained by teachers to do this. But the Buddha, what would make him question this absorption into self? What would make him see that? This thing that we never even question. What would make him stay with discomfort and see it without following the impulse to fix it, to get it worked out right? I think for this to work, though, we have to follow the impulse and not follow the impulse. We have to follow the habit and not follow the habit. You have to see what happens if you follow the habit and what happens if you don't follow the habit. You kind of change it up some to throw the mind off. But then what the Buddha did, this is what I think, this is the last thing I'm really going to talk about, because this thing that the Buddha did, this is not, more and more as I practice, I see this is all quite part of the whole. It's all quite interrelated with each other. Because if you think about it, mindfulness is what keeps us from getting trapped in clinging. Mindfulness. Without mindfulness, the mind will automatically absorb its own self into some habit selfing. It will absorb itself. It doesn't need you. It will obsess over the thing, whether you want to obsess over it or not. It's going to keep bringing it up, keep reminding you, we didn't get that salad. We need to work on that. It's going to take us away when something happens. You know, I saw this news clip of this guy that was getting evicted out of his apartment. He's this young kid. He had two little kids, and his wife and him and the two kids, they were getting evicted. They didn't have anywhere to go. They didn't have any extra clothes. They didn't have anything. And the mover was so upset. He was crying, and the sheriff is almost to tears. Everybody's so upset because this kid has got to get out of this apartment. He's young. And he sounded like, I'm just trying to, you know, I lost my job during this pandemic, and we're behind on our rent, and, you know, that's our fault. And I don't know where we're going to go, but we're going to just try to keep it together, and blah, blah, blah. He's going on and on. I mean, I'd say within 2 seconds, I was lost into some place, overwhelmed with sadness for this guy. And just remembering my own lives, my own difficulties I've had. You know, so I send all this metta. But then I read today that so many people, they set up a GoFundMe account for him, and so many people contributed to this GoFundMe. And then his story brought the reality of all these people that are going to be homeless because of this. And so all this money started getting raised to help all these families that are going to be, you know, evicted and thrown out. I think that day that he was being evicted, 200 people got eviction notices also. So the point that I'm saying is, I did not, when I looked at the clip, I didn't know the mind would get lost and absorbed in that moment. This is the difficulty we're working with. We're not working with a mind that we control whether the mind gets absorbed or not. The mind will absorb itself on its own. Just like it absorbs itself and unifies around a meditative object, it will absorb itself around anything. You will plan not to be a part of a habit, and then all of a sudden you're in the middle of it. You know, you don't even know how you, I thought I wasn't going to do that anymore. And then boom, you're right in the middle of it. So this can't be, oh, I'm going to not get caught in clinging. This is about using the opportunity you have. So if you've noticed yourself caught in the mind's grasping, I mean, the mind's clinging, you're not going to really notice it until you're suffering. So at some point, you're going to realize where you're at. Then you practice with that. And that's the practice. Not any regret about how did I get here? Just practice with, oh, this is where I'm at now. What can this tell me? And then if you notice the wanting of it and you haven't fallen into and the mind hasn't grasped a hold of it, you practice with the craving, the wanting of it or the not wanting of it. Or if you happen to can appreciate that even sooner moment of just this felt sense of pleasant, unpleasant, then you practice with that. These are the places, it's this discomfort that we're finding it. And what I was going to share was the way that Buddha interlinked all this is so profound to me. Because if you think about the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas, and these satipatthanas establish mindfulness. And we need mindfulness in order to not fall into clinging. The four satipatthanas are the body. So you're going to have to feel something in that body. Feeling tones of pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. You feel that tone, that quality, tonality of it. These thoughts and emotions, you're like feeling into how our body is thinking, emoting about experience or our relationship with it, like the hindrances or the seven factors. This kind of noticing, how am I being with it? So oftentimes we will feel the aversion of something, even though we don't necessarily feel the something. We feel the aversion of it, or we feel the desiring of it. So what Buddha basically is saying to me, what he's saying is, it's in this felt sense of embodied discomfort that we actually can begin to see what it is that's driving our suffering. And not somehow the ease that the mind is convinced once everything gets smooth and easeful, now I know I'm going to be okay. It's a reason why the Four Noble Truths start with suffering. I mean, everything about our practice is about learning to get still and steady with suffering. So when we are not suffering, this is going to sound really bad. I know if there's not any Buddhists in here, you're going to be like, what? What kind of practice is this? when we are not suffering. We are somewhere lost in some distortion here. This is the difficulty here. That sounds terrible. You know, my family used to make fun of me because they would be like, if you want to suffer, I can help you. You don't have to pay. You can pay me. I can make stuff miserable for you. You don't have to go pay all that money for a retreat. There isn't honor in this suffering. There isn't honor. It's not the ordinary kind of, we're not talking about ordinary things going wrong in life. That's not what we're talking about in this suffering. That's the first start. What we're talking about is when we get so caught in the not liking this first start that we get absorbed in one of these mental distortions to try to make it right, to smooth it over. And oftentimes that smooth over works. We get peaceful. We feel happy. Ah, I'm settled. Everything's good now. And that's kind of the trick. So this practice of renunciation, doing no harm, this right intention, right view, like it's not about you, and then right intention to try to practice with a level of kindness, the gauge becomes harm, not whether something goes right or not. Can you learn to feel harm and not run from it? Can you learn to feel discomfort? And even though you may very well intend to alleviate that discomfort, can you first feel it before you alleviate it? Can you first get a sense of the quality of it so that your alleviation is coming from a mindfulness, awareness of what you're doing and not a gut reaction? All in all, I think that everything that the Buddha is pointing to with this dependent origination, with the Satipatthanas, the Four Noble Truths, all of this practice, everything is pointing towards learning to be with our felt sense experience of life. Whatever it brings us, we need to feel into life and not just go through the motions. It's not that there's a problem with going through the motions, because that's just what we do. But every once in a while, you will notice that you're going through the motions. And when you notice that you're going through the motions, what would it take in that moment to just stop? Maybe pause a moment and feel where you're at right there. Just take a moment to feel where you're at right there. It's almost like remembering that the body, to the Buddha, he pointed to the body, the body, the body, the body, the body. If your body understands pain, but your mind doesn't understand it, yeah, I'd go with the body. It understands. The mind doesn't understand, but that's the least of our ability to discern. Let's see here, just a minute. Let me see if there's anything else. Yeah, I think this is it. I think I just want to encourage you to begin to see this is kind of a hard thing to see, but to begin to see how sleep we are most of the time. This month we want to see, if you want to see clinging, you're not going to see it through pain like we did last month. Last month, the craving, you see it by how much wanting you want. And you feel that out of the wanting. But if you want to see clinging, it's a little bit of a different kind of obscure seeing. You see clinging by noticing how routine everything is. How much of what you're doing, you can ask yourself from that old commercial, young people may not know this, but the older ones, is this live or is this Memorex? You just check. Am I here or am I remembering? Did I just walk into my house, or is the mind remembering what the house looks like and I just happen to have walked in? Right? That's what this month is about. Noticing, is it live? Is it Memorex? Am I here or am I lost in some memory or some thought about here? This is what we're, so it's an easier place than suffering, but it's harder to see because it's so obscure. So why don't we, before I end, let me just, what did I do with my nun? Oh, here it is. Let's just listen to what the other Sama said. Some of these poems are, yeah, they are a bit much. What some of these women went through is shocking. Anyway, she said, after 25 years on the path, I'd experienced almost everything except peace. When I was young, my mother told me that I would find true happiness only in marriage. Remembering those words all those years later, something in me began to tremble. You see that discomfort? Something in me began to tremble. I gave myself to the trembling, and it showed me the pain this little heart had ever known, all the pain this little heart had ever known. And how countless lives of searching had brought me at last to the present moment, which I happily married. This present moment, this phantom long body. Can you imagine? We've been living together ever since without a single argument. This is it. This is this fathom long body. It's what our path is. We're not gonna find liberation anywhere else. We're gonna find it in this body, being with it, married to it, connected to it. Our own bodies, each one of us, already has the wisdom to tell us how to liberate itself. We just have to listen. So thank you for your kind attention. Let's just sit a moment and we'll let this gel a bit. Okay. Let's see if there's anybody that has any questions or comments. Yeah, Susie. Oh, do we need to let you unmute yourself? Let me see here. Yeah, you should be able to unmute.
Wow, that is power, turning on and off people's voices. I have the same question over and over and over again. That was Torah. That was like five Dharma talks in one.
Okay, good.
That was so rich. But I wake with morning depression, and mm-hmm. I don't feel like I know what it is to make friends with that. That isn't about the mind saying, oh, I know, right, I'm supposed to make friends with you, and then it'll all be better, you know? So it's like when you talk about obscure. So if I go on the path of the body, and I'm sure whatever the question is, the answer is more practice. I know. But it's like that moment, the moment of contact that comes before taking off, you know, and having the second air or whatever. How do you slow that down enough to make that? Because that's what you're saying. It's all in that it's all there.
So
it feels like the gateway, you know, to really
it get is.
The felt experience.
All right, so I'm gonna go out on a limb here. You have to check me if I'm wrong, and I don't have such a big ego, so I might have to be checked. That's okay. I can take it. But I'm gonna go out here on a limb. The thing that you are, the obscurity you may not be seeing is that the depression is the habit, not that the mind has the habit of waking up depressed. And so it keeps doing that, and you keep treating it as if, oh, I wake up and I'm depressed, assuming that the mind's depression is in fact what you are experiencing. That's why I'm saying you have to question, is it live or is it Memorex? Is it a memory of a time when you were depressed and the mind has never let it go because it has the habit of continuing it over and over and over and over? And some ways to begin to help you see this habit is you have to go against the grain of it. So it's sort of like when you have anxiety. With me, it was anxiety. So when I had this anxiety, what I thought was, this is too painful. I'm about to have a heart attack. I need to move. But I would go against the grain of that anxiety and I would not move. And I would tell myself, you're not having a heart attack. This is a memory. This is a habit. This is not true. And even though I am feeling anxiety, and I can tell you, I felt it, it did not seem true at all what I was saying to myself. I said it anyway. So part of what you have to do, if this is what I think you have to do, is you have to start telling yourself over and over and over, this is a habit. It's a habit, a habit, a habit, a habit. It won't seem like a habit because you'll be telling yourself it's a habit and it's going to feel like, no, this is reality. But you just put your faith in the path that there is something obscure that I cannot see. Rather than resolving that this is what it is, and I am resolved to live with it. I'm not saying that I don't want to get this confused. The reason why it's out on a limb is because there is clinical depression, and I've had to take an antidepressant because of it. So it's not like all depression is all habit energy. What I'm saying is, if you notice yourself waking up a certain way every morning, but then, you know, after a while, the fog kind of lifts and you go about your day. That's habit. That is the mind telling me I need to get that salad. That's what the mind is doing, telling me I need to get it. And the mind is now used to you getting up depressed every morning. And so every morning it creates all the conditions that makes that happen. And then you walk around with it for a certain portion of your day. And I'm assuming that at some point the fog lifts. You just want it to lift in the morning. And the only way it's going to lift is if you start saying, this is a habit. This is not true. I can't see it, but I know it. I just have to keep questioning it, poking at it, seeing if it's really true or is it a habit. That makes sense?
Thank you. It gives new meaning to the button. I remember question authority.
Yes. That's right. That's who you're questioning, the mind's authority, because it's going to do this. This is what we got to get. The mind has no incentive to stop waking you up in depression. It has no incentive. It thinks this is the most efficient way to get you up in the morning. So it will do it every single morning for the rest of your natural days. And the only way you're going to get out of it is if you start questioning whether or not this is real or habit. You start questioning it. And then you can begin to see something other than the habit the mind keeps putting in front of you. You'll have to tell me how this is so I don't go out on a limb and like scare the daylights out of people, you know, that really need some support and help because they really are depressed. But I just got the way you were saying it. Like, I keep doing this. I've been doing it all the time. It's always here. This is what happens. And I didn't get a sense that you're saying you are depressed. I got the sense that you were saying, I wake up depressed and somehow it fizzles out sometime at some point during the day. Anyway, that's my thinking.
Thank you.
Let's see if there's somebody else. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Jean.
Yeah. So I'm curious about when you're talking about getting like watching the video of the family being evicted and how
yeah.
you got absorbed. So I get absorbed in those stories all the time.
Yeah.
But it seems like can create empathy or at least some, you know, experience of interconnection, because I feel when it feels, you know, when it makes me cry because somebody's having such a hard time. Could you say a little more about that? It's clinging or it's, I don't feel like I'm totally lost in the story, but I feel it.
I was lost. Because I went back to my old thinking. I was not feeling the guy's pain anymore. That's the way it started. I realized what woke me up was I realized I was thinking about all these old scenarios I had lived through. And I saw that thinking and that's how I knew, oh shit, I totally lost that. I totally left. I went somewhere. This is what I'm saying about the four foundations of mindfulness. It established this mindfulness because I've learned to watch my thinking. So when I start noticing I'm lost into some old stuff, I'm not in the present moment here. So no, you're right. I'm not saying that when I first felt his pain, I was there with him. I felt that pain. That is real. That is empathy. That is compassion. But I lost it when the mind moved into this selfing thing about my life and where I've been and how I've been and all of my world stuff. And once you're gone in that space, you don't know that you're gone until something pulls you back into this reality of where you are. And so that's what I was pointing to, is that the mind can go on its own. It's not something that I don't want to create the image that, oh, I'm not going to self anymore. The mind selfs on its own. It goes, it sees something, it associates it with my past life, and I was there, gone with it. And so we're practicing to have mindfulness wake us up from that being gone, triggered, lost somewhere. And so it's usually pain, some kind of suffering that wakes us up. And that's what it was. I started hearing myself talking through and remembering all these experiences I'd had similar to his. And that's what got me to wake up. But yes, you're right. We do want to feel that pain. We do want to commiserate with it. We do want to be with it. But we have to be careful not to let the pain that we are connecting with trigger us into being lost in all the selfing about it.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about this a little bit more, but when we do the second one, but part of one way that we do that is you can get lost in your opinion. So this is one way grasping mind happens. You see something or someone says something. Let's say you see somebody not wearing a mask, right? And before you know it, you've walked 5 blocks and all you're thinking about is, I cannot believe people that don't wear masks and blah, blah, blah. And you're like totally gone into your own opinion. That's clinging. You've left the present moment and you're up in this opinion and you're off in it. You don't even know it. And then when you start feeling the suffering of that opinionated argument, you're coming back down into the body. And you have this opportunity to re-wake up and come back into mindfulness again. But the being gone, that I think is the natural part of mind. So our practice is not so much, we use the mindfulness to begin again and to begin again and to begin again, but it's not necessarily to keep us from being gone, because that part, I think the mind does on its own.
I have a question.
Sure. Go ahead, Allison.
You said that giving into our habits is sort of this, it's responding to our need for permanence and stability. And that makes sense that that's not something you'd want to do all the time, but it seems like there are habits that I have that, whether it's my daily schedule or certain thing, mindfulness practices that I use when I'm, markers that I'm, when I'm brushing my teeth or whatever it is, mm-hmm. That support my practice and are healthy and they're good for my self-care, getting enough sleep at night. So how do you balance those two sides of habit, the habit that can be just feeding this need for permanence and stability versus kind of habits that are wise or healthy?
I think it's the habit of it, not the action that you're doing, right? So going to bed at a good time, paying attention when you're brushing your teeth. When you're paying attention when you're brushing your teeth, it's not actually the habit, it's mindfulness. Or when you're watching and paying attention to what you're doing, you know, your practice when you're sitting there meditating. Where it gets a problematic is when we do sit down, do our sit. Okay, I'm done with the sit. Okay, now I'm going to go do this. So we're not really engaged in the sit at all. We're not really engaged in things. We're doing things to create the stability that I'm doing okay. Look at me. Things are going good. I got my sit going, got this going. Everything's good. And then you get caught off guard because you have this sense of permanency, even in the things that are being done habitually that are good, what we consider good. It's the habit part that's the problem. But to pay attention to brushing your teeth so that you stay in the present moment, in the body, brushing your teeth, that is not habit. That is mindfulness. If you pay attention to your sit and you sit at a certain time, but you watch the clock, you know what time it is you're going to sit here, and you're coming back to the body over and over and over, feeling the four satipatthanas, that's not habit. That's mindfulness. That's strengthening mindfulness. So what you're pointing to the habit as I sit every day at a certain time and it strengthens my ability to be still. But that is mindfulness. Habit is when you're not even paying attention to what you're doing and you're doing it just for the stability of wanting it done. Do you see the difference?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of more, I guess I was conflating it with discipline or structure.
That's right. Discipline. That's what it sounds more like. Discipline is part and parcel of how we stay with the mindfulness. So we create discipline, structures, things like that, like you're saying, so that we stay with it. And it supports us to remember to come back and come back and come back. But that's not the habit of not paying attention. You're just doing it kind of lost.
Thank you.
You got a little munchkin behind you.
I do, yes. And a little bit of what we're talking about. Also avoiding bedtime.
That's what I thought. But that's okay. She's doing good. So it's like it's cute.
It's a good thing he's cute.
Yeah. Cute. All right. So, oh, yeah. Go ahead, Lauren.
Well, it seems to me there's a connection between the four distortions and habit.
Yeah.
Would you say there is?
Yes, that's what I think. I think the four distortions is the nature of that habit. And then we're going to talk about these four ways in which the mind grasps, which kind of puts those distortions, makes them kind of real. Like our opinions. We think our opinions are real. And so we don't, our beliefs, our opinions, we think everybody believes like us. And when we hear somebody that doesn't, we're like, what the hell? Where'd you come from? What are you believing? It's like, yes, no, I don't believe that. It's like that. So yeah, I think the distortions are the thing that the mind, it's like the glue that keeps that habit in reality. Over
right.
And over and over.
Because it's what we do to, because we believe in that distortion. So we have to do, it's really not true, but we have to do something to make it feel like it's true.
That's right.
We're kind of attached to that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're going to talk about that more in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.